I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the White River Festival, a two-week-long series of events aimed at focusing attention on Central Indiana's water resources and the challenges before them. My guests are Jill Hoffman, the Executive Director of the White River Alliance, Tim Stottlemyer, Stormwater Manager for the City of Noblesville, and Lance Lance, Superintendent of the Street Department and Head of Stormwater Management for the Town of Zionsville. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the statehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about some approaches to solve pressing Central Indiana challenges that are holistic in nature. The overall focus of the show is going to be about the White River Festival. That's a series of events taking place over several days that place a spotlight on Central Indiana's water resources and the challenges before them. And my guests, when we are talking about that, are going to be Jill Hoffman, who is the executive director for both the White River Alliance and the affiliated Clear Choices Clean Water Program, Tim Stottlemyer, who is the stormwater manager for the City of Noblesville and president of Clear Choices Clean Water, and Lance Lance, superintendent of the Street Department and the head of the Department of Stormwater Management for the Town of Zionsville, and he currently serves on both the board of directors of both the White River Alliance and Clear Choices Clean Water. I'd like to welcome all of you to the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's good to have you here. But first, we're going to talk about, again, this is a holistic approach, a different way of meeting what is a pressing problem confronting Central Indiana. An upcoming project from WFYI, we're going to be talking with the reporter who's doing the work on that, Ryan Delaney. And Ryan, the title of the project is intriguing. It's called Intersections.
It is.
Could you talk with us a little bit about what Intersections is or are, might be, depending upon the grammar?
Sure. Well, of course, it's a play on a few things, but we're talking about six intersections and six intersections in six neighborhoods of Indianapolis, and these are the six neighborhoods that the City of Indianapolis's Public Safety Department has identified as some of the most violent murder rates, and one of these in particular is 1,000 times more prevalent than the citywide average. And the Public Safety Department, that being police, fire, as well as a bunch of community organizations that Public Safety brought in, are trying to really look at this with an analytical and a holistic approach to get at some of the root causes of crime as a way to hopefully then cut down on murders and shootings that happen in these neighborhoods. We're only talking about 8 square miles here of the city, which is about 400 or so, 5% of the population, but yet over 20% of homicides happen in these neighborhoods, almost 30% of non-fatal shootings, about 15% of all the city's mental health runs in about just these 8 square miles. And like I said, they're trying to get at the root causes of this crime. And I talked with Troy Riggs, who was sort of the architect of this program, the former public safety director of the city.
And he's been a guest on this show several times.
Talking about this. You know, he lays this out pretty well, that some of these issues that they're trying to tackle and how they then cause crime.
And you've got some sound from him that we'd like to hear.
Any area that's having trouble, that has a degradation of quality of life, and that's really all we're talking about. Crime is an after effect. When you look at this, the breakdown of family is one of the glaring issues in each one of these areas. It leads to a lot of issues. Lack of education, lack of coping skills, a lack of people being fed properly.
That was former Public Safety Director Troy Riggs, who's going to be featured in a new project, storytelling project from WFYI. We're talking with Ryan Delaney, who's a WFYI reporter, about that that project right now. And could you talk a little bit about the scope of the project, when it's going to be airing? I'm assuming we're getting a sneak peek here.
We are, so you're welcome.
yes, thank you.
So we're launching tomorrow. You'll be able to hear a radio story tomorrow during Morning Edition at about 6:30 and 8:30 in the morning. And then again, if you're listening during All Things Considered at about 4:50, that first piece will air. And that's kind of just very much an introduction and an explanation of these neighborhoods and the problems that they face. But we're also doing a whole lot more than just this one radio piece. And when listeners and viewers and readers, whatever you want to call them, WFYI.org/intersection. Will be the website for this project, and if you click, go to that link right now, you won't see anything. So a little bit of patience. We're still tweaking.
Wait until tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow it will be live, WFYI.org/intersections, and up there we have some amazing photo essays, some interactive maps, and some graphics, and a lot of web-only content. And about every other week or so, look for an additional piece, and we're looking at it's going to be a combination of stories about the causes of some of this crime, mental health care, hunger, as well as profiles and looking at some of the effects of this crime and how that weighs on people that live in these neighborhoods and profiles of the people that are really trying to solve it.
And you've got some more, you know, another snippet from someone else that is affected directly by this.
Yeah, Pastor Jay Height, who runs the Shepherd Community Center. It's obviously a community center and a church on the Near East Side of Indianapolis. And he's lived there himself for about 2 decades in this neighborhood. And he's really seen a lot of the changes and the decline in the quality of life and the economic situation there. But there is one sort of aspect of this neighborhood that he still sees as a positive and one that they want to play off of in order to sort of restore some of the quality of life in this neighborhood.
And let's hear from him right now.
It's a place where there is still, the porch is still in the front. And that's a sense of community. And I think the greatest challenge we have is we've lost some sense of community. And with the loss of community, then there's no social capital. And if there's no social capital, you can't bring about societal change. And so what our goal is to really build on that community. The problems didn't develop overnight, and the solution isn't going to happen overnight.
That was Pastor Jay Height. He is featured in a new storytelling project from WFYI Radio called Intersections. We've been talking with Ryan Delaney, who's the reporter who is spearheading that. It rolls out tomorrow morning, right?
Tomorrow morning.
Early, and will continue for the foreseeable future, right?
Yes, this
every other week.
This isn't going to be a short-term solution, and it's going to take a long time. So this is a reporting project that we're going to spend a long time on.
Wish you the best with it. Thank you very much for stopping in and talking with us.
Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
Certainly. Certainly. Well, I want to pivot in some ways what Pastor Height was talking about there was a conservation argument about preserving what is in the common good. That, in some ways, is the animating spirit behind the White River Festival. I'm only on the radio. I just can't talk. White River Festival. And that's what we're going to talk about now with Jill Hoffman, Tim Stottlemyer, and Lance Lentz, who are all part of the White River Alliance. Jill, could you start out by talking with me a little bit about what the White River Festival is?
Sure. Yeah, we're really excited to be hosting this in its fifth year. It's essentially a two-week-long, or in this case 17 days, series of events across several different partners that are all aimed at trying to just bring awareness about our water resources and some of the things we can do to protect them and how to enjoy them and how critical they are to quality of life issues, some of the things like you were just talking about.
What the motivation for doing this? Well, actually, I want to get to the motivation a little later. Why don't we talk instead, because people are probably going to be intrigued by this, about what the events are and where they could find out more information about those events. Jill, I'll start with you.
Sure. The best place, of course, is the website, because all the event details are there, locations and information and family friendly and all those kinds of pieces that you'd want to know. So the website is whiteriverfestival.org.
Feel free to give that again, people.
Okay.
I've tried to ask them, but they don't drive around with pencils
right.
in their hands.
Hopefully it's simple enough. Whiteriverfestival.org. Mm. So that's the best place to find out. But we like to organize the events in kind of a creative way we call waters, right? So things that are related to wildlife or arts is the, in case if you're spelling out this WATERS acronym, right? Or training and learning or service, those kinds of pieces. So if you think about it as kind of maybe buckets or groups of events, you could attend things that are creative in nature, like poetry reading or art activities or art installations even. Or you can do some educational kinds of things, learn about aquatic insects or other animals at the zoo. You can take walks or do hikes or rides to have direct experiences with the river. And then, of course, some service things like our river cleanups. So those are always a big part of festival.
And I should ask, and I'll ask Tim and Lance to step in here, too. I'm presuming, you know, the White River is not a fixed place and that,
right.
that it's a small. So I'm assuming that that these events are spread out over a fair distance. I'm seeing Lance nodding his head at me right now, so I'm gonna go with him.
Yeah, in a broad sense, this runs all the way from Anderson area up north, and the White River kind of cuts diagonally down to the south southwest through Indianapolis, all the way down to Morgan County. We've got events all along there of all types. So not only are there a wide variety of activities, but we've got a geographical spread, so nobody should have to travel too far. And it also shows how much commonality there is to the areas up north. We're all living along the same water body. We may be 40, 50 miles apart, but we're sharing this same asset.
And in terms of determining what sort of events, what message were you trying to send through the festival? How do you want people to focus their attention on the White River? And really, you're talking about something larger than that, water issues in central Indiana. Tim.
Sure. Well, there's lots of different opportunities. In Noblesville, we chose to have an event that had several different components that were all separated and build on that to join in with the Alliance then. And ours was came out of a long history of a really effective river cleanup and that had been going on for 20 years. So we needed to reinvent it to something new because we were, frankly, running out of trash. We had been so effective over the 20 years of the cleanup that we needed to go into the next phase. So,
good problem to have.
It really is a good problem, but our community was very used to showing up on the second Saturday in September to be involved, to make a difference, to make change in our community. So we found that we needed to reinvent the our day, and this was a perfect way to join in with what was going on upstream from us and downstream from us to help leverage the whole opportunity.
And in terms of did you go through, and I'll throw this one back to Jill, go through and say, you know, we're going to try to plan activities that are site-specific, that what might be important in Morgan County isn't necessarily going to be as important in Noblesville? And how did you go about figuring out what might be important in those different places?
Well, early on, we had a couple of meetings with a lot of different partners, and we realized that there are these common messages that you were kind of asking about earlier, you know, what things unite people and what could they rally around. And so some of those simple things were about how we're connected to our waters and our actions change them. And so that kind of let everybody rally under this umbrella of the festival. But the events are as unique as the partners. So that's the fun part, because there's a big diversity, and they capitalize on whatever their assets are and whatever kind of venues that they can promote and use. So we don't script it for them. We help them kind of give them the right call to action resources to use, or help them by these kinds of media appearances so that we can all lift up our collective voice. But the events themselves are created by the individual partners. So
And who are some of those partners?
Oh, okay. Glad you asked me that question, actually, because it's a pretty big range.
Well, saved you from having to drag them into the conversation.
Right. And I won't hit them all, but we can kind of think of them in some big groups. So some of the cultural institutions that you're familiar with, like the Zoo or Connor Prairie or Minnetrista way up in Muncie, the Children's Museum, those kinds of places are our typical partners. Our cities and towns, like Lance and Tim represent, they are doing significant events on the calendar. Different arts groups, universities, nonprofit groups, local businesses. We have a couple of the breweries involved, so you can figure out how water quality relates to your favorite beverage. So a lot of different partners.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the upcoming White River Festival. It's a 17-long-day series of events that's designed to highlight or focus attention on Central Indiana's water resources and the challenges before those resources. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Jill Hoffman, Tim Stottlemyre, and Lance Lentz. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the White River Festival. That's a 17-day-long series of events that's designed to focus attention on Central Indiana's water resources and the challenges that face those resources. My guests are Jill Hoffman, who is an aquatic biologist and is executive director of the White River Alliance, Tim Stottlemyre, who is the stormwater manager for the city of Noblesville and also is a board member of the Alliance, and Lance Lentz, who is the superintendent of the street department, head of the Department of Stormwater Management for the town of Zionsville, and also is on the board of the White River Alliance. Well, before the break, we talked about the festival itself. We probably ought to talk about the issue that it's supposed to focus attention on here, and it is about really to get people to think about the challenges confronting our water resources in Central Indiana. I'm going to give each one of you a crack at that, but what are the big challenges before us? Since I started with Jill last time, I'm going to start with Tim this time.
Okay. Well, as a municipal entity, we fell under some new regulations or some changes to the Clean Water Act in the mid-2000s that require municipalities to take responsibility for all of the drainage that comes off of our community, community-wide. And those are separate storm sewer systems. EPA uses an acronym, Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System, and the whole idea there is that 'cause the city owns all of the roads and all of the storm drains and pipes that lead to the rivers, creeks, and streams, the city is responsible for every bit of pollution that gets washed down those storm drains. And this is what they call non-point source pollution or just simply polluted runoff that comes off of our entire landscape. So we're responsible to move the needle on that, and it's the exact opposite of a factory discharging a point source or a single pipe. It's that in some ways is much easier to change that point source because you know where it's coming from. Conversely, the polluted runoff comes from everywhere and all kinds of habits and industry, business, citizens, fertilizer, you know, the list is almost endless. So we're charged with moving that needle.
It sounds like that requires a really change of community or cultural mindset in regard to how you approach water, how you approach, to some degree, just how you dispose of almost anything.
That's exactly right.
Lance.
Yeah, certainly. Now that Tim's covered the very exciting government regulation portion of that, maybe we can get into the fun and exciting portions of the festival. But
it's okay. We've got an audience that's got an attention span here, so you're fine.
As Tim alluded, there are national government organizations, state government, and local government organizations all challenged with cleaning up our rainwater, our stormwater, our runoff. But what the festival is really trying to do is drive this down to the individual level. The White River and water resources seems to be kind of a hidden asset that you don't always think about until you turn the tap on. It's just one of those things that shows up. We, as a group, like to watch that very closely. It's not hidden to us, and we see the degradation in the quality. And we've kind of got this mindset as individuals that as long as I get it out of my house and away from my house, it doesn't really matter. You know, I've been surprised in past education settings where teachers who teach the water cycle consider water a renewable resource, and that's not the case. If we all remember that water cycle from our younger days, at no point did they say this is where Mother Nature infuses more water into the system. It comes around and gets recycled. So this festival is geared at raising awareness of the river and the importance it plays as an economic driver for our industry around here, our recreational uses. We really need to stop treating all of our creeks, rivers, and streams as waste conduits because we have an asset. I think that people out west would love to have the problem we have every spring when we've got soggy backyards. So we're trying to change that mindset and capture this resource before it leaves our community.
Jill.
Wow. Good thing I bring you guys. Take care of most of it for me. I guess I would like to add my perspective as a biologist to it, maybe, in that we have a lot of different sources of pollution and they cause a lot of different impacts. And as Tim mentioned, they're diffuse. So, you know, this is kind of death by 1,000 paper cuts or death by 1,000,000 paper cuts. And the levels that we see in our streams in terms of some of those pollutants really can't be solved with an engineering fix. They need to be solved socially. They need to be solved by reducing the amount of pollutants we put into the environment in the first place, which, as Lance kind of alluded to, starts in your own backyard with the choices you make around your house. So what we're hoping to do with this year's festival is bring a united call to action among all of the different partners so that when people leave festival events, they know exactly what they can do at home so that we're celebrating the river and our daily behaviors, not just 17 days in a calendar year. So I think we need to just focus on reducing what washes in there so that we're not having to clean up the effects, which are both expensive and risky to public health later.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the upcoming White River Festival here on No Limits. That's a 17-day-long festival series of events designed to focus attention on Central Indiana's water resources and the challenges before them. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Or you can do what a listener named Elliot has done and just give us a call. Reach out to us the old-fashioned way at 866-476-3881. Elliot, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just calling. I am actually hosting one of the events for the Right River Festival, along with local artist Doug Berkey here in Anderson. It'll be at Park Place Arts, opening on September 12th. And it's entitled Requiem for the Wapahani, which is the indigenous name from the Miami people for the White River. As you're probably aware, Anderson is kind of the epicenter in terms of a fight to dam our river here in the downtown
area.
That's
Thursday's show.
Great.
Yeah.
So our exhibit is going to kind of bring to light through creative production, through photography, sculpture, installation, textile work, filmmaking, original music, what people draw from the river and how it affects them creatively.
And if people want to attend, Elliot, at when and where again?
The opening will be September 12th here in Anderson. That's a Saturday from 5 to 9. And the show will run from September 12th to October 24th Arts in Anderson.
So that's well beyond the 17 days, the scope.
That's
you're going
right.
More than a month.
It'll run for about 6 weeks.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling in, and I hope you'll come back on Thursday when we're talking about the Mounds Project.
Thank you, John. Appreciate
Certainly. Take care. Well, we've done shows actually on the White River before, and one of the themes that's sort of a subtext to our conversation today, too, is that it's one of those things that people just don't think about, there's this resource, literally in some cases in our own backyard, that we pay very little attention to, that we take for granted, and there's been a fair amount of talk here in recent years about how we can elevate the profile of the White River. I want to start first by asking why it is so easy for us to overlook the White River, why it is not part, you know, like I've lived in St. Louis, and believe me, the Mississippi is a very powerful presence in that city, in a way that, admittedly, it's a much bigger river than the White River, and helps shape that city's history a lot more. But why it is that the White River is almost ignored here in Indianapolis? I've given Tim and Jill a chance to talk first, so I'm going to go with Lance this time.
Well, I think that we simply don't recognize it for the asset that it is. Years ago, when it was considered navigable, prior to a lot of siltation and changes to the depths, I think it served the Indianapolis community in a much different capacity. I think it's now, like many resources, simply taken for granted. It doesn't serve a day-to-day purpose that is ostentatious. The Indianapolis area hasn't really built a culture before this around the river. So I think that because it doesn't serve us outwardly on a daily basis, it's just taken for granted. We would be lost without it, but we'd like to re-energize that celebration of the river. And so the people don't take it for granted. We start developing these cultures along the river in different portions so that we can make sure that it is perpetuated and continues to serve our needs beyond just recreation.
And if I'm hearing Lance right, he's saying at one point, particularly when it was considered navigable, or at least more navigable than it is now, that the perception of its importance to the community was greater than it is now. When did that change occur? I'll start with either Jill or Tim, whichever one of you. And Tim has just thrown Jill under the bus. So, Jill, it's going to you.
Well, it's funny. We like to do these tours a couple times a year where we launch from the Broad Ripple area, and we talk about what Broad Ripple Park used to be in the early 1900s and these, you know, historic double-decker paddlewheel boats and groceries being delivered up and down the river and people coming there as second only to Coney Island as a place to recreate and almost in a circus-style format, what happened at Broad Ripple Park historically, it was the it place to be. And being on the river was a great, fun, and almost, I guess, a braggable place to spend time, right? And then I think what you saw happen is a lot of our waste had started to get discharged to it. We started to see the effects of combined sewers, and then people started to, I guess, have a sense of it being polluted and dirty and less of an asset and more of a nuisance, maybe. So, you know, we're making a lot of strides to clean up that quality of water. And I think it's frankly time that we turn around and face the river again and think about how to make it front and center and make it the asset that some of the other great cities in this country do with their major rivers. So,
how long ago was that change? I mean, it sounds like it was a century or so ago that, and maybe even a little more if they're talking about double-decker paddle wheel.
Yeah, those were early 1900s, you know, 1904, okay, so 1905. And then the 20s and 30s was pretty big time for that area of the river. And so it's nice to revisit that, but it's also, you know, nice to look at it and say, hey, we could do that again. We could really make this community cherish this asset that not only could be a recreational asset, but it is the primary source of their drinking water. So, you know, we need to face it, and I think we need to cherish it, and we need to step up and do what we can to protect it.
So, Tim, how do we go about doing that, elevating the profile? I mean, obviously, have a festival is one way, but in terms of that 17 days, how do we do it the rest of the time?
So, you know, the cleanups and all the events in the calendar are important, but what we hope people do is take away a greater awareness of what the issues are and small things that they can do in their own backyard, their business, their lifestyle. The sources of this are thousands, tens of thousands, you know, of different sources. And so those are going to be the fixes also. Those same sources and problems that degrade our water are going to be the things that if we can create social change and stewardship, then that's where we start to eliminate that. And it's the social change that we started with, you know, in the conversation.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the upcoming White River Festival and how we can preserve Central Indiana's water resources in a more efficient and more responsible fashion. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, we keep talking about some small ways that people can be more responsible in the ways that they approach. I love the phrase, by the way, Jill, that we need to turn around and face the river. in the ways that we confront or face the river. What are some of the ways that people can be more responsible? I'll start with Jill.
Okay, well, we have a great program that we'd like to give a shout out to. It's called Clear Choices Clean Water. So clearchoicescleanwater.org, and it's simply that. It's all the individual choices that you can make to help clean up the water. So I actually had a conversation with an artist friend that helped us start the festival way back, and she had this phrase about the river starts at your front door. And I really believe that's true, because every storm drain connects all of us, our property, and our experiences every day. So the choices that we're talking about in Clear Choices are things related to, you know, the fertilizer choices you use on your yard. So not only what type, but maybe less of that, preferably. Native plantings. We brought you in a couple of nice clippings from some wildflowers.
You did. It's a pity this is not a visual medium, because people would love seeing those.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, we can really re-landscape our yards and create beauty and quality of life while treating stormwater and helping get some of that water pushed back into the ground by those plants' roots. So we also have pet waste campaigns going on, a water conservation campaign that we've put together with the help of our partners at different utilities. So that's been great. And then the service campaign, just telling people how they can help take care of their storm drains, keep the grass clippings and the leaves out of them. I mean, this is sort of collective assault on the environment, and so it has to be collective solutions. And so just little stuff. Yeah, clear choices.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the upcoming White River Festival. It's going to be a 17-day series of events designed to focus attention on Central Indiana's water resources. Don, welcome to the program.
Wow, thank you very much for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have a question. I've been involved in a number of the cleanups over the years with the Friends of the White River. And my question pretty much is this. Do the people that dump in the river, is it easier for them to pay the fine and just dump, or is there some real teeth in the ordinances through the cities that the White River flows through? Is there some teeth in the ordinances that if you're caught, you pay a hefty fine, and it reduces the likelihood of dumping?
Good question, Don. Thank you very much for the call. We'll see if we can get you an answer, Tim.
In the city of Noblesville, we have ordinances that fall under the stormwater program that do allow us to fine up to $1,000 per day per incident and go beyond that if we need, plus remediation costs. So catching the people is always the issue. We have a report a polluter mechanism that people can go to the website or phone in, stay anonymous, and can report illegal action. The idea is nothing but rain down the drain. So if somebody's dumping chemicals in a storm drain, that will still make it to the waterway, and that would fall under the same kind of enforcement. So, yeah, we do have teeth. Different communities have different realities on what they're able to enact, and that's kind of a local will kind of thing. So I think the answer is different in different communities.
What are the standards of evidence to catch for that $1,000 fine there?
Sure. So, we have a progressive scale. So we have, you know, whether it's a residential homeowner, commercial, industrial, we hold our industrial partners and people who are in business to a little higher standard. They should know better. And then whether it's an accident or intentional. And so we've got a progressive fine all over there that kind of grades that out. We require photographic evidence or a city employee eyewitness kind of thing. So
you'd have to have like someone with a cell phone camera or whatever,
right,
taking a picture of someone dumping something.
Right. And we don't see as much dumping directly in the river as we used to. It used to be everybody's trash can. That's where they'd get rid of their tires, their couch, and that kind of thing. And that has thankfully slowed down. It's more dumping things into a storm drain out of ignorance. They just mm-hmm. don't realize that these things lead to our creeks and rivers and streams.
What sort of things do people dump into storm drains?
Motor oil, concrete waste, Lance. You can
if it can fit between. Now they don't dump me down there. If it can fit between the slots, I think that people get to send it down there. But I think one thing that people don't realize is that natural detritus, just the leaves and grass clippings that you would think would be innocuous in a storm sewer system, are in fact not innocuous. The accumulation of those can lead to as bad of effects as some of the things that you would more conventionally consider toxic.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the upcoming White River Festival, which is going to focus attention on central Indiana's water resources. My guests are Jill Hoffman, Tim Stottlemyre, and Lance Lance. They're all connected with the White River Alliance. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the White River Festival today on No Limits. That's a 17-day long series of events designed to focus attention on central Indiana's water resources and the challenges confronting those resources. My guests are Jill Hoffman, who is the executive director for both the White River Alliance and the affiliated Clear Choices Clean Water Program. She's also an aquatic biologist. Tim Stottlemyre and Lance Lentz, who are also connected with both the White River Alliance and the Clear Choices Clean Water Program. And in addition to that, are stormwater managers for Noblesville and Zionsville. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Philip, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, Philip. Yeah. What's on your mind?
Oh, when you think about the dams, like the one right there at 16th Street, and then you've got another one at Washington Street, to look at them, there doesn't look like there's any warning or something to keep you from going over them. So if you wanted to paddle up and down in Indianapolis, and you'd have to worry about that. And there was a way to forge it to go around the one down at Washington Street and go on down south. You could start in Indianapolis and come back and go as far as you wanted. But the way it is, there's no way to get through. I don't know how to get on the river very many places at all.
Well, thanks very much for the call. I'm going to try to get an answer for you, Philip.
All righty. Thank you.
Certainly. Jill.
Sure. Hey, Philip. Thanks for your interest in being on the water. We try to do that with the festival, give people as many direct experiences as we can and get them to the river. So a couple things that might help a little bit are one of our festival partners, Friends of the White River, they actually have a new app out that tells people where they can get on and off the river and help navigate some of those hazards like the dams. So that might be something to check out if you're in the world of apps. So there's a good place to go for that. And I hear what you're saying, and I know there's some history. The city has looked before at those two particular dams and what to do with the stretch in downtown Indianapolis. So it would definitely need to be handled creatively in terms of water levels and impacts and that kind of stuff. But, you know, looking at riverfront redevelopment is a growing issue, not just for Indy, but Tim is looking at it in Noblesville. Fort Wayne is looking at it up on their rivers. And so there are ways to manage those things. And I think what we need to do is just get people more interested in taking a look at what it means to be on the river, both hazards from water quality and hazards, physical hazards, and how to work around them.
Yeah, I think we've got an email from a listener named Elizabeth that speaks to that point. And if you'd like to reach out to us and join the conversation by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Elizabeth says, I live in the floodplain near 80th Street and Keystone at the crossing in a beautiful wild neighborhood called River Park. Mm-hmm. Our White River is taken for granted and ignored because it has become so polluted. Back in the 1800s, prior to all of the pollution in the form of human waste, animal waste, farm runoff, and industrial runoff, the White River used to be a large harvesting site for freshwater pearls. It used to be that clean. Now it is so toxic that one runs the risk of bacterial infections for simply wading in the river, let alone eating fish from it. We as a state must make it a priority to clean it up from both an agricultural waste and industrial standpoint, as well as leave it as a free-flowing entity and bring it back to life. Jill, I'm assuming, and you, she's preaching to the choir there.
That is true, actually. And we love your neighborhood, too. We take people on boat trips up there all the time, and they continually are impressed that, you know, that for some people living in Indy, they're living waterfront and, you know, the beauty and the wildlife that comes along with that. But She's right. There's definitely risks. And so, you know, we're working on projects all the time to help reduce that pollution load. And that's what we need to do.
What would it take to bring those pollution levels down to an acceptable degree of safety? I'll throw that one to either Lance or Tim.
Well, I think that a lot of the industrial discharges that were some of the early violators of laws and introduction of pollution into the waterways has been largely taken care of because, as Tim mentioned earlier, a point source is more easily regulated. What it's going to take? It's going to take activities, as we've been discussing today, in people's behavior and changes in behavior. You know, it took decades and decades for the water to degrade as it has, and it's going to take decades and decades to return to some semblance of its former glory. But here to the caller before, we do have this asset, and we've continually used it to its detriment. But it really is a grassroots initiative. You can find out who's dumping oil in and who's pumping superheated water in after cooling tanks, but you can't find the people that over-fertilize, that do the illicit discharge. I've just changed my oil. I'm going to dump it on the rocks here close by. And most communities that are the MS4s, as Tim talked about earlier, we're really striving to get
MS4.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's the municipal separate storm sewer system.
Okay,
and those are the communities that were identified back in the early 2000s as requiring an NPDES or National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit to treat our water as we do wastewater. Better development practices is key to the rejuvenation of the river, and most communities like Noblesville and Zionsville and Carmel and some of our partner organizations have really taken giant steps to try and mimic nature. We're not better engineers than nature is. Nature did a fine job of existing before we came along and tinkered with it. So most of the development practices are returning to that. Stop looking at it as a waste project, trying to infiltrate it. So if we can get more communities on board, then I think that that's going to be a key factor in the health of the river.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the White River and the ways that we can preserve it. Martin, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Certainly.
I have a couple of quick questions. The first one is, could you talk a little bit about the pet waste program that you mentioned earlier? We've got two giant dogs, and we're constantly struggling with what to do with their waste. And also, could you describe to me, I mean, I like the idea of the festival, but what you were saying about the river in the 1920s just sounds incredible. I wonder what that would look like today. If everything were cleaned up and we could, you know, get back to having the river be a fun place to be, what would that look like?
We'll start with Tim on that one and then throw it to Jill. Sure. Thanks very much for the call, Martin.
Thank you.
Sure. So as far as your pet waste goes, you know, picking it up out of the yard so that during heavy rains the bacteria doesn't get washed into the storm drains and eventually into the river, that's the key objective here. There are several alternatives, I guess, on what you can do with it. Regular trash, or even there are some digesters some companies have that you can put in depending on how big your dog is and how large your waste stream is and if you've got an area in your yard that you would want to install a digester. On the Clear Choices piece of that, you can go to clearchoicescleanwater.org and simply there's some good information on that website that will help with that. But what you can simply do is just take a pledge and say, I pledge to pick up my pet waste so that it stays out of the waterway. And then it places a pin on the map to where you can see where you're at and others who are taking action just like you are. And when you start to see that cumulative effect of one little action and the power that that has by one individual multiplied by all the other individuals, that starts to have real power and it doesn't feel so small anymore.
Jill.
Yeah, I'm a dog lover too, so I struggle with that. And I swear, Tim, they produce faster than my digester will work.
I have a new puppy that is only 20 pounds, but you would swear he was 80 pounds already.
I know. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, we love pet owners that are responsible. And, you know, as Tim was talking about Clear Choices, part of taking those action pledges is that you can invite your neighbors or post to your social media. And that's the kind of mechanism that helps to get some social change brought around. So I appreciate your interest in that. And, you know, I often talk about this issue and we make light of it because it's poop and people don't like to talk about it. But, you know, it's an unregulated waste stream. And there's really no other waste stream. Even our cattle operations, you know, have some kind of regulation over their manure. And so, you know, we have to kind of stop ignoring that this manure over hundreds of thousands of dogs in areas with a lot of impervious hard surface, you know, creates a problem. So thanks for that. I don't know exactly how to answer your question about how to get back to the vision. I can tell you that communities are working on riverfront redevelopment ideas, and the more you put those ideas in front of city council people and let them know that you want to revitalize our rivers, that's where it starts. I mean, that's what we need is a bigger vision where, you know, planning and zoning start to take a look at how do we get back to our rivers with a sustainable development and be able to enjoy them, but also protect them at the same time.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Bob, and I'm going to ask our listeners who are calling in and actually our panelists, we're starting to get a lot of calls. So if we can abbreviate both questions and answers here and try to give as many people a chance as possible. Bob says there is a CASO sign right across the street from my house on the bank of Fall Creek that says danger, raw sewage, keep out. There are also many signs claiming the same along the White River close to downtown. How can the public even begin to take an interest in the river when the water is flowing with sewage? Jill, I'll go to you on that one.
Okay. Well, I'll take what I can. Tim, Noblesville is also a CSO community, so Tim might be able to help too. But there are projects going on. So the EPA has told these cities that have these combined systems that they need to address this issue and reduce the overflows. So I'm sure that you've probably heard about the Deep Rock Tunnel being built here. And that project is designed to help capture and contain a lot of those overflows and help reduce significantly the number of sewage events that we have in the river. So those are big infrastructure investments, and they're happening in all of our major cities.
And in Noblesville as well.
Yeah, the sign is a regulatory required sign. So if there is a pipe there that it has the potential to ever overflow under any circumstances, the signage is required to warn the public that that's the case. I know in Noblesville we've invested 80-some million dollars in our old systems of pipes and treatment, and virtually reduced or eliminated all but the very worst, you know, those really catastrophic rains are the only time that anything would overflow and nobody would be in the river then anyway.
We are talking about the White River and the challenges in front of it here on No Limits. Les, welcome to the program.
Hi, I appreciate you taking my call.
Certainly.
I wanted to specifically focus on some of the agricultural aspects of your discussion today. Agriculture, both row crop and large-scale animal agriculture, obviously contribute a large amount of nutrients to the system. But I want to make everyone aware, make your audience aware, of a major initiative that is going on as we speak. It's called the Conservation Cropping Systems Initiative. And this project is a project of the Indiana Conservation Partnership. The partnership consists of the Natural Resources Conservation Service, a federal agency, the Indiana State Department of Agriculture, the Indiana Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and all of its 92 members in each county, along with Purdue Extension. And our program is designed to basically change behavior among agriculturists by doing a systems approach to production agriculture. By a systems approach, I'm referring to practices like no-till, the use of cover crops, nutrient management practices, along with the implementation of all of our really cool precision agriculture tools that allow us to operate, you know, very close to what we want to apply. We do have a website. I would invite your audience to, you know, check it out. It is ccsin.org. And this, again, this is a project of the Indiana Partnership, Conservation Partnership. We're in our sixth, going on 7 years. We are also doing a considerable bit of data collection and analysis. We're doing research on manure application to apply appropriate levels of phosphorus and nitrogen to our soils.
If I could jump in, because we are running a little bit tight on time here, could I ask you to do a favor and go to our Facebook page and put all of this information so that people can grab it for it? And you can find us at No Limits WFYI on Facebook, because it sounds like you're doing some worthwhile stuff there.
And very exciting program.
Yes. Thank you very much for the call and for the information. I appreciate it. Well, and it sounds like that's exactly what you guys are talking about, is finding creative approaches to figure out ways to reduce the problem at the beginning. And since I mentioned Facebook, I should say that we have got a question from a listener named Taylor via Facebook. She says, or he, I don't know, Taylor is one of those names that go either way. Is it true that the city is considering cutting down all the trees along White River between Broad Ripple and Meridian? Has anyone heard about that?
That's nothing that's been brought to our attention.
Nothing that has been brought to your... Okay, well, we're going to try to squeeze one more call in here. Richard, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. There were some comments made about bacterial contamination in the river earlier. There are there's a sewage plant in Noblesville, a sewage plant in Fishers, at least one or more. There's one in Carmel. And during the so-called recreational season from roughly May to October, they are required to disinfect their effluent. In other words, they have to use, most of them use chlorine or UV to kill a bacteria in the effluent that's coming out of the plant. During the rest of the year, they're not. So you have a continuous flow of contamination in the river. Many states require year-round disinfection. Indianapolis does not. Or Indiana does not. In addition, you have a lot of small sewage treatment plants that discharge into connecting streams to the White River that are very poorly regulated and increase the bacterial load.
Richard,
and
thanks.
Until such time as there's enforcement of environmental laws, it's not going to get any better.
Thanks very much for the call. I want to give my guests a chance to respond to that, but thank you very much for the call and the comments. And I'll throw that one to Jill, I guess. I'll give you the last word here.
Oh, the last word. Okay. Well, I appreciate that comment. I feel like I might have recognized that voice from one of our river advocates. So, yes, bacteria comes from a lot of sources. And the caller before that mentioned agriculture. We've talked about pets. We've talked about wastewater. So it's a collective problem, lots of solutions. I did want to just touch back on the agricultural piece. We are working on adding a piece into Clear Choices to really promote practices up in our ag areas as well. So I'm working on a concept called soil health that I think will change a lot about how our cities work cooperatively with our rural areas for holistic water management. So watch for that.
And real quickly, again, give the URL for people who might want to take part in the festival.
Okay. The festival is whiteriverfestival.org, whiteriverfestival.org. And then, of course, the Alliance has its own webpage with all of our programs. And that is thewhiteriveralliance.org.
I'd like to thank my guests, Jill Hoffman, Tim Stottlemyre, and Lance Lance. We're going to be talking about water some more on Thursday when we're going to be talking about the Mounds Project. I'd like to thank all of our listeners. Hope we will try to get to all of your questions on Thursday. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.